This is Fresh from the Pod.
My name's Tamsin Westhorpe. I'm known as a garden writer, but I'd actually rather be known as a good old-fashioned gardener. I spend most of my time at Stocktonbury Gardens in Herefordshire. It was so exciting to be able to show a Gardener's World TV presenter round the garden recently. I hadn't met Nick Bailey before, so I was intrigued about his journey onto our television screens, and I wanted to hear more about his books and his passion for horticulture.
Right, Nick, I've bought you cake, and appropriately, it's got a calendula petal on the top. Are you a cake person?
I am. I mean, I've tried to cut sugar, actually, in the last few months.
If you've given up sugar, have you taken up anything else to fill the gap?
Gosh, no. I mean, I tend to eat quite tediously now, actually. I've always been a big cook. I'm sort of now just trying to hone a menu, really, that's as healthy as I can possibly muster, but... yeah, it's a fine line. So I find myself kind of eating just chicken and rice and broccoli over and over again. And so I'm trying to sort of step that up and try and get a bit more interest going.
But it's difficult, isn't it? If you're out doing a talk, I went to see one of your talks last night, you know, you cannot be home till midnight and you've left too early to eat tea. Yeah. I find I'm sitting in the car eating garage sandwiches and crisps
Garage sandwiches, terrible. Yeah, I mean, I travel with a full larder in the top of my rucksack. You know, I don't want to be that person on the tube when I'm traveling through London that's tripping everybody over with a drag behind suitcase. Yeah. So I always have a rucksack, which everybody in TV seems to find hilarious, but it's most practical for me. But the top pouch, I've always got a big bag of peanuts, big bag of fava beans, which is great, an emergency can of coffee, emergency bottle of water. So yeah, I'm ready to keep myself alive.
Because your schedule must be quite ongoing, isn't it? What's sort of like a normal week for you, or is there such a thing?
I'm very lucky that I work with somebody who's absolutely brilliant at all the things I'm rubbish at. So she's brilliant at doing bookings and accounts and administration and all those things. So she brilliantly sends me a message at 7 o'clock every Monday morning that tells me what I'm doing for the rest of the week. And so a typical week, I suppose, one of the things I do is a big estate that I look after, a big private estate. And so I go there on a Monday because I'm sort of training up the team there. So I've taken on a head gardener and a woodsman. That sort of starts my week, you know, back in a garden, in a substantial garden. And then it rolls from there. So I've generally got a couple of bits and pieces to write. So I write for several magazines, so I slot that in. And then it tends to be some filming in the week. And that can often take up 2 days because there'll be a day of travel. I seem to be the northern correspondent for Gardener's World, so I sort of cover everything above Manchester, so it's often quite long travels and things. But again, that's great because I can write or I can, you know, sit and relax, and I tend to train nearly everywhere. I don't have a car myself at the moment, and actually that's great because it's quite like turning off my phone and nobody can get at me. You know, I can just focus on the writing.
Are you at a stage in your career where you can pop to Boots and buy something without somebody going, "Hello, Nick, it's Nick Bailey off Gardener's World." I mean, has that kicked in?
It's a funny thing. So I went on a date fairly recently, and I'd reassured this person that there was no need to worry. You know, I don't get spotted in London because there's not that many gardeners in London or not many people. And it's true, I don't generally get spotted at all. We were sat on a park bench about 10 minutes into this date. Guy went past me on a racing bike, skidded to a halt, ran back up the path and said, "You're that guy off Gardener's World. I saw you on telly last night." And I said, "Oh no, this is exactly what I promised wouldn't happen." And then something really embarrassing happened last year. I was sat on a tube train with my friend and just regaling this tale that I'd thrown a load of stuff away at my flat. And opened up the communal bins, and there was a whole pile of gorgeous silk ties in this bin. And I thought, well, does this make me a terrible person? But I'm going to take these. They look perfectly clean. They're perfectly good. So anyway, took these ties and telling my friend about it. Didn't think anything of it at all. And then about 10 minutes later, we'd got back up onto the street, and I suddenly got a message on Twitter that said, "Hello, Nick Bailey, 365. I was too starstruck to speak to you, but I hope you found a good use for those silk ties.
No, that's
the embarrassment.
Hilarious.
So I have to be a bit aware.
You have to be white and white and good as gold.
Yeah, which I'm definitely not. For me, at the moment, it's still novel, and it's nice. I imagine for Monty or somebody who's got a really big profile, it probably starts to get a bit wearing in the end. But
so we won't see you walking around in wigs and dark glasses quite yet.
I mean, I might be wearing wigs just recreationally, but not for disguise. I was given great advice, actually, that if you want to not be noticed, the worst thing to do is wear sunglasses and a baseball cap, because that says I'm hiding. So you should either wear one or the other. And apparently a hat is a better disguise than sunglasses. So if you need to go incognito somewhere, this is the approach.
Right, all handy tips.
Yeah.
So did you ever intend to be on TV? Was it one of those happy accidents, or is it something that you thought, that would be great, that's where my skill set lies?
It's an odd journey, really. When I was a kid, we used to go swimming every Friday night, and the schedule was set absolutely by me that we had to be back in time to watch Jeff Hamilton, of course, on Gardener's World. And then I had my own little sort of patch of garden within my parents that probably went up to the size of the room we're in now, so sort of 6 by 5 metres, by the time I was sort of 10 or 11. And I'd set my mother up that if I had friends calling after school wanting to play, I was a bit embarrassed at that stage that I was so into gardening. So she would, I'd sort of pre-set her up with this, that people would knock on the door and she'd say, oh no, he's grounded, he can't come out. Truth was, I was busy in my garden. And one of the things I used to do as a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old was pretend to be presenting Gardener's World from my little patch. So yeah, exactly. And then in my sort of late 20s and 30s, I'd done a bit of media work, and I'd been working on magazines. That was the first time I'd encountered you. I think you were on a rival magazine.
Oh yes,
you?
We were enemies maybe for a while.
battling to get the
the
ABCs.
Get the sales.
Yeah, exactly. And so to late 20s into early 30s, I really started to sort of push for it. I thought this is what I want to do. This is the route I want to go down. I did a few screen tests and nothing came of it. So I kind of thought, okay, that was my shot. I'm going to be too old now. Nobody'd be interested. I need to refocus my career. So moved into botanic horticulture, which was just wonderfully, wonderfully fulfilling thing. But that in itself seemed to sort of generate a whole load of new stuff. And so I started appearing on little bits of TV, BBC News, ITV News, Great British Garden Revival, Monty's other show, The Makeover Show. And more was happening. Gardener's World were looking to recruit again, and thought, no, I had my chance, they're not going to be interested. So I didn't bother. And then heard this recruitment process had happened, and they had 800 applicants for
800?
It. 800? Apparently so.
Wow.
And so I thought, okay, well, they're bound to find somebody. And then I just had a phone call out of the blue saying, would you screen test? I'm going to avoid being an awful name dropper here, but two extraordinary people had recommended me, and I was so, to the BBC, and I was so flattered. I would set up this screen test. And I'd managed to make a bit of a professional screw-up the day before, completely different related project. And so going to this screen test, I was just in abject panic. Like literally I was sweating with anxiety about what had happened. Nothing intentional, but I'd messed something up. And so I thought, oh God, this is just an omen, never gonna happen.
Yeah.
Went to this garden, it was in the middle of winter. I was covered in anxiety sweat and it was freezing cold. So it was just like horrible conditions. Did my stuff and then heard nothing and thought, okay, clearly that's not gonna work. And then I was in the back of a truck, about as unglamorous as you could possibly be, in Spain, driving around gathering up plants for a project, and had a phone call that went along the lines of this. Oh, hi, Nick. It's so-and-so from BBC. Are you able to film on Tuesday? And I'm like, what? Film what on Tuesday? And she's like, well, The Gardener's World. And I'm like, but what happened?
Exciting.
And, and that was how it all began.
And did you squeal? Did you?
Yeah, I was... just ecstatic. I mean, it was just an extraordinary thing to happen. Having given up on it so many times and thought it would never you know, never happened.
But always sort of, that's, you know, the excitement of life, isn't it? When the unexpected happens, it is so much more exciting and rewarding. The core of what you and I do is this love of plants, isn't it, and gardens. And anything that stems off from that is completely relevant. It doesn't matter if it's TV, magazines or gardening. It's all so connected. But you've obviously looked after the Chelsea Physic Garden, which is incredible to have on your CV, isn't it? How did that come across?
Yeah, it was a very special thing to do, and my God, they put me through my paces to get that job. So I had an initial interview, which was 3 hours long, including a practical test, a plant identification test, a management test, and then scrutiny from the current HG and the curator. I thought, oh goodness, I've never been through anything like this. This is extraordinary, but hopefully I'll hear in the next couple of days how it's gone. I did hear, but what I heard was you need to come back for another interview for a panel of five people headed up by, you know, the god of horticulture, Chris Brickell. And so I was just, oh no, can't handle this. Came up from Norfolk, and I'd allowed sort of 2 hours of sort of mess up time for transport. And I thought, you know, nothing can go 2 hours wrong. By whatever it was, 11 o'clock in the morning, we'd been sat outside Ely train station, trapped in this train.
Yeah.
And so I already knew I was going to be late for the interview. I was getting more and more anxious. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I ended up getting to London, ran from Sloane Square to the Physic Garden. I remember as I sat down on the desk, I tipped my head forward and this massive blob of sweat dropped down on the table, and I just thought, this is just not going to happen. This is a disaster. But it did. What was so extraordinary was the level of freedom that they afforded me. I was sort of so energized to reinvigorate the garden. You know, I didn't want to change its spirit or the genus loci or the essence of the place. I wanted to enhance what it already did. And so certain things like the medicinal plant collection had shrunk down to a few hundred square meters. And of course, that was the reason for the garden in the first place. So I wanted to push it back up to an acre of the garden. And Chris had said that he was a chair of the trustees at the time. And he just asked me if I had any sort of particular ideas once I was in post about how I could see the garden developing. And said, oh, can you show me after the advisory meeting? And so I'd just done this very, very, very rough sketch with a marker pen. Anyway, during the advisory meeting, he announced that I had a master plan for the garden. Do I? Anyway, so I had this one scrappy piece of paper and all these kind of eminent people, you know, Tony Kirkham and, you know, key people from industry. Anyway, ran downstairs, photocopied it, and extraordinarily, it was signed off there and then as a basis for a redevelopment of the garden.
I think the best garden plans, garden designers would be furious with me, are made on scraps of paper initially, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Back in the fag packet.
Absolutely.
Where magic happens.
I mean, the things we see as presented pieces of garden design, you know, beautifully rendered, hand finished, that's the resolved design being presented. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. The design process, the reality is happening in your head constantly, and it's that scribble on a napkin, or I often even like to sort of 3D construct things. So the garden I did for Chelsea Flower Show, I built that entirely to scale out of
matchsticks.
Well, bamboo canes. No, it was to scale, so it was one to one on my father's land. So it was built of bamboo canes, cable ties, and then because he has a few events, he has endless white plastic chairs. So I literally tied them to each other to make the planting. So I did the form and void and volume to try it all out. I mean, I often say it as well to clients or, you know, when I'm teaching, that, you know, just try it out in your garden. If you're thinking of putting a hedge there, shove a post in the ground, put a piece of string on top of it, hang a sheet over it, just see what it's going
to
do.
Good tip. What always surprises me is if you've got a small garden, I would say to people, get rid of all the little features you've got and put one whacking great big pot in there.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good tip. Gosh, I didn't realise you'd have made that garden out of chairs and bamboo cane before.
Crazy. I mean, I think for me, gardens are a series of bits of flirtation and revelation. And I think that's how they should work. You should get a glimpse or an idea of what might be beyond, and it draws you and you move into the next space and it creates a different atmosphere, different feel. And all of that is to do with the fundamentals of, I'm a plantsman at heart, as I think you are, but also as a trained designer, I have to step back sometimes completely from the plants and think purely in these sort of form terms. So it's form and void that I'm thinking about. Where are the blocks of solid stuff? Where is the sort of translucent stuff? And then where is all the sort of connecting tissue that pulls it all together? And the what's not there is as important as what is there. You know, if you're framing something, highlighting something, there's those gaps and air spaces that, and you're absolutely right that small gardens, if you play around with lots of little features, lots of little things, it can feel very messy, uncohesive. And so I often say to people exactly the advice you said, which is put something massive in, or break the space. It doesn't need to be 100%, but just partially break the space. Give that sense there might be something beyond, even if there isn't.
Yeah.
That just adds the magic for me.
I mean, what I would recommend to some people is take everything out of the garden, all your sort of little statues and baskets and pots, take them out of your eye line and then go upstairs and look down on the garden. And actually, 9 times out of 10, it looks better. But it's like having a living room, isn't it? We all add things over the years, and occasionally you need to go in and just start again, don't you?
Yeah, declutter. And I think as well that 3D thing is really important to me when I'm designing. You know, I'm not the best artist, I'm not the best at drawing, but I can generate fairly quick sort of perspective sketches that I understand. I mean, I wouldn't dream presenting them to a client, but because I think it's so easy if you're entering into garden design, if you're thinking about recreating a space, to design it from the crow's eye view. And of course, it's only the crow that ever sees that. And so often you see this very sort of pattern-led design that doesn't necessarily work on the ground when you're in that three-dimensional space. It might look great and pretty from above, but does it actually work when you're in it? And so I think that's why the 3D stuff is so important. Mm. Now, I must confess, I'm a complete Luddite, and I could probably do it very fast if I was using computer-aided design programs and the like. But also, when I see things being presented prior to Chelsea, and you see, you know, the best of the best designers often use these graphic programs that create near photoreal images of what their garden's going to be. And actually, I think I'm setting myself up for a nightmare if I do that. You know, I'd rather have something much looser and more sketchy rather than saying, this flower will be exactly here against this beautiful piece of rock.
Yeah. But when you created your Chelsea garden, was it as you expected it to be? Because obviously, like you're saying, some people do it with all the photographic images. I can imagine you maybe stepped onto it and thought, yeah, that's better than I thought. Or this bit, it isn't quite how I'd seen it, but it works. Or what was your view on your garden when it was finished?
It was an extraordinary process, Tamsin, if I'm honest. And it nearly killed me. It
yeah,
really
I
did. I've never encountered anything that's so all-consuming. You know, you live it for 6 months up to the point you actually wind up on site. And then it's, whatever the build is, 18 days, about 15 hours a day, managing 40 people. And just this whole time knowing that this thing that's come out of your soul, your being, your spirit, if that doesn't sound too pretentious, you're putting out. And you know, the press says, the RHS says quite openly, 1 billion people will be exposed to this. And so you're literally sort of spewing out your heart and soul and saying, world, judge me. And so that the fear is extraordinary. But what was lovely for me was that I had very, very distinct, the plan was set and fixed. My lead planter, Alison, was absolutely brilliant. And she's worked some really big names in the past. She sort of started setting out some plants on site. I'm like, sorry, Alison, I can't see the planting design. How are you putting these together? And she's like, planting design? I'm like, yeah, you know that thing I did that's the design
taking
of this
me hours.
Garden?
Yeah, hello.
And she's like, oh, I'm not really sure I've followed one of those before. And I'm like, well, I'd kind of like you to kind of fit in with this. But then I sort of realised the sort of team collaboration and the sort of the evolutionary aspects of it, just having those other eyes on it. And so I had my palette of plants, my approximate layout, all my structural stuff was as it was. But the team just started to sort of play and tweak with a few things and suddenly got these little subtle effects that I hadn't necessarily envisaged. And so it then became this sort of more organic thing. I think the thing that shocked me most about Chelsea was that you forget that everything you put in is growing as you put it in. And so we caused lots of other designers to be in sort of panicked state because at the start of week 2, we were already planting. Now, we knew we had to do that because the garden, I mean, I did the most absurd amount of planting. So if you remember the garden, it's about 70% plant. We knew we had to get that far ahead, but it's panicking everybody else. It's like, you're putting your plants in and we haven't even finished our hard landscape. What was amazing was I used one particular lupin masterpiece, you know, that gorgeous one from Sarah Conover. We had plants growing in six different locations, three of which were Europe, three in the UK. But these all arrived and they were just in bud. They were just these green wands. And I thought, oh my God, this has cost us a fortune. They've been pushed, they've been forced, and they're not going to flower.
Oh.
But that was on day 10, and by day 19, they were fully coloured. And so to return to my point, is that everything's growing because it's at that wonderful season at the end of May where everything's just pushing and pushing and pushing. And so the garden itself suddenly evolves and it becomes its own thing. It suddenly becomes real. And, you know, at the most cynical end of Chelsea, I think it's a giant flower arrangement and it sets up almost definitely false expectations. You know, we've messed with all of those plants to have them come into flower at the exact time, be at their peak moment. You know all too well that if you returned to those gardens untouched 2 weeks later, they would be horrific. There'd be virtually no flower. Everything's so densely planted, things would have wiped each other out. And so it sets up this thing that you know, gardeners, viewers, TV viewers see this stuff. Why doesn't my garden look like that? And the truth is, nobody's does.
Do you think people then look at their garden and think, I'm failing?
I think it can have that effect. I mean, I think it's definitely an inspiration. And I have to say, you know, I'm feel blessed and I feel incredibly proud that without question, Chelsea is the best flower show in the world.
Absolutely.
And so, like you, I've been involved with it for 20 plus years, whether that's reporting from it or being there as a landscaper or finally being there as a designer and then finally as a TV presenter. So that fills me with pride. But also, I think Britain produces the best TV in the world, and I think it produces the best writing in the world. And so I'm very proud to be a part of all of that. So horticulture, writing and TV, I think Britain excels at. And it's lovely to be within that world and, you know, striving away and doing
what
I can.
But Chelsea feels to me like the beating heart of that world. I mean, I just find when I'm there judging on the Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And I leave on the Monday and I would honestly stay there. I would sleep in that marquee. It's not more than the marquee, isn't it? But it's just, I don't know what it is. It's just, there is like magic fairy dust over it, isn't there?
It really is. How do you, I always wanted to ask a judge this, how do you find removing, you know, because there's very strict criteria you're working to, how hard do you find it to remove your personal taste from what you're judging and being able to, do you have to sort of battle with yourself?
No, I think the judging process is so cleverly done and we spend so long on the garden, so many of us. So there'll be assessing judges on the first day, then there's another set of judges. And you're looking primarily for quality, for plant associations, for structure. There's so much to all the gardens. It's so brilliantly put together, and judging with people who have vast experience, I'm learning all the time. You know, it's an incredible process.
That must be good.
Very fortunate. So when the show was on, did you pick up people's vibes about what they thought of your garden?
Well, because I'd only just started doing TV the year before, I wasn't sort of generally recognisable at all. And so adopting my either hat or sunglasses, never the same. You know, maybe this is a bit self-indulgent, but I used to hang out in the crowds. And, you know, a bit of a trumpet blowing here, but we had nearly the thickest crowd the whole week. And so it was sort of 10 to 15 people deep. And it was a lovely thing. So I'd just stand in the middle of the crowd, not saying anything, and just listening to people's observation. And, yeah, there was something very disarming about that, and you know, a few unpleasant comments, but 99% of it was positive, and that was a really lovely thing. I mean, I walked away with a silver gilt. It was a point off gold, so it was very disappointing. But actually, to hear how it affected people and how people were talking about the plants, how they could extract certain elements for themselves, I kind of thought that does make me feel like a winner. But the whole thing was just such an extraordinarily emotional process. And I remember on the final Saturday, looking at the garden, everybody had gone off site, had one last look at it, turned, walked up Main Avenue, burst into tears uncontrollably, just had my head down, and out of nowhere, someone just grabbed me and put their arms around me, and it was Cleve West, and he said,
I know what's happening, mate.
Yeah, and it was a lovely thing. There's also another magic moment. We'd obviously been tense with the build, and we had all these, you know, these metal Danish trolleys packed with plants all around the garden. So for the last probably 8 to 10 days, I couldn't see the garden. There was no point I could stand and actually see it. And then suddenly, all at once on the Sunday, all the trolleys shipped away, and suddenly the garden revealed itself. And that was nearly the sort of perfect moment. And then an extraordinary thing happened. You know, this is the magic of Chelsea, is the press day on the Monday morning. I just remembered overnight, all these little Brisbane media, which had masses in the meadow at the front, and they have, of course, those lovely little heart-shaped hanging flowers, but they came into full bloom at 8 o'clock on that Monday morning as the light cut across the garden and this sort of, you know, sort of sparkle just danced across the whole meadow as they moved. I was like, oh, okay, we've done it.
Is it very sad when you have to start dismantling the garden, though?
I realised I couldn't cope with that, so my final look at it on the Saturday was the last time I ever saw that garden. I couldn't bring myself to be there to rip it all apart, because it had been my heart and soul and being for so long. I mean, it was important to me that it wasn't skip-dumped, so it was two charities that we chose, and so the garden got sort of reused for two new gardens. So I was very glad that it could have a second life, but I couldn't have coped with seeing the bulldozers come in. It's
No, I can fully understand that.
Have you done show gardens yourself? Or
no,
been involved?
But when I was a student, Sparshot College, they're always very involved. They have displays, so we got involved with that, and we did have one with a magazine once. I remember doing the sell-off.
Oh yes!
Crikey, that's dangerous. I want that. And you're watching these people carrying vast plants onto buses and tubes because they all just want that little bit of magic, don't they? They want that Chelsea plant. It's totally impractical.
It's funny, for all the decorum and sophistication of Chelsea, as soon as that bell rings, suddenly all madness breaks loose, and you know, very respectable ladies in Chanel twin sets suddenly get vicious with their umbrella if they
throwing
need to
money
get to
at
the
you.
Front.
Very good fun. So once you've done something like that, I mean, would you do it again?
It's a funny one. I guess it's probably like a childbirth thing. For at least a year afterwards, I was saying never, ever, ever again. Can't put myself through this. I'm almost annoyed with myself now because I can feel it starting to well up again.
Dear.
This kind of, maybe I could do one. And you know, I was extremely fortunate that I was approached to do the garden by a sponsor. Yeah, if that situation were to repeat, I probably couldn't resist. I mean, I learned a great deal doing it. You know, as much about people as I did about plants and management and logistics and, you know, the dynamics of what's happening on site. But I'm sure you must have discovered when you were doing the sort of builds, that sort of banter, that kinship
friendship
on site.
And, it is. That's what it's all about, isn't it, gardening, is people.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think I'd be brave enough. Now, you've written books. And the book that I love the look of, you'd sold out of them last night at your talk before I got to you, so popular. It was The 365 Days of Colour in the Garden.
Yes, the snappily titled.
Well, it does what it says on the tin. A photograph by the wonderful Jonathan Buckley.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's going to be a
man.
Good book. Exactly. Was that a book that you've always wanted to write, or did you just, how did that come about? Was that a passion project or something that happened by mistake?
So I've been doing garden talks for 15, 18 years. And at one point I had them listed on a website. And what was interesting, I had 6 or 7 talks, and I had one talk called 365 Days of Colour in Your Garden, and that got 90% of my bookings.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, there's something here. So I was approached by a publisher to write a book about medicinal plants. And I said, I can do this, but I'll be writing it as a student of this subject. You know, I'm not an expert. I'm still learning. You know, it was 3 or 4 years into being at the Physicon. Mm. But I have got this one idea, thinking it would go straight in the slush pile and never happen. And extraordinarily, they picked up on it. And I think probably that statistic I've just quoted to you is one of the selling points, you know, that 90% of bookings were that idea. Because I genuinely think it is something that most gardeners, you know, strive towards, just getting year-round colour and interest. And certainly when I worked on the magazine that was competing against yours, I was coming up with the content for the magazine, or proposing the content, and I found that I sort of kept coming back to these sort of key subjects about, you know, what is the longest flowering rose? How many months can you have daffodils in bloom in your garden? You know, it's about 7 months if you get it right. How do you get things to flower longer? How do you get things to flower later? How do you pair colour? All these things. And my, you know, part of my background, aside from horticultural study, I studied landscape design as well at Greenwich, and the first year of that was pure fine arts, which opened up another world to me. And so I realized this sort of deep interest I had in color and how it affects us, actually. And it does profoundly. And, you know, I always start the talk, the 365 talk, by saying, you know, when we reference color in the garden, we're talking about the brights, the vibrance. But actually, and just looking out of your windows now, 95% of what we're seeing is green.
Green.
You know, that's the palette that we start with. And it's a beautiful palette. Everything goes with it, which is a great start. There's so many textures and tones, and of course now transitioning into another season and taking on those sort of autumnal tones. So I think that's an essence of colour is just intrinsic to gardens. And I, not that it would necessarily completely lead garden design for me, but it's a massive, massive component.
I loved your point that you mentioned last night about the right colour to educate children in. And because I have a teenage son, I thought, right, my ears pricked up. And it was orange, of all things.
Yeah, really, really interesting. I mean, just the effects colours have on us. Something I mentioned last night in the talk is, you know, traditionally drawing rooms, you know, where you withdraw after you've had your chocolate pudding and your whiskies or whatever, and you're feeling a bit tired, but nearly always red. And of course, that causes your body to secrete adrenaline, and it causes your heart rate to raise, therefore wakes you up. And so even going back a couple of hundred years, whether they knew the science or not, but they understood that being in a red environment changes our sense, changes the way our body's working.
So talking of relaxing, what do you do to relax? Garden or something totally different?
Okay, so my own garden at the moment is very small, but I specifically bought the property because it was a garden flat. And so I do sort of tinkering gardening. Now, most of my career has been about big scale gardening. And so now I actually really enjoy doing, you know, tweaking rose petals and deadheading and doing the little bit because nearly everything's containerized. So I find that quite sort of mesmerizing, quite a great way to switch off. But about 3 years ago, I climbed off my bed in the morning and made this very strange noise, and then realized I'd gotten off my bed like I used to see my grandfather getting off the sofa in his 90s.
Oops.
And thought, oh gosh, what has happened to me? And I'd become a bit of a desk jockey. You know, my job had taken me further and further into management. All my sort of muscles had wasted away. I'd got a sort of a 70-year-old's butt, which I certainly wasn't aspiring to have.
No.
Completely flat. And so I thought I needed to change this up. And I'd been to gyms before, and they just don't work for me. I don't like the environment. You know, the cold virus lives on cold, wet, damp surfaces, and that is a gym. Mm. And so I found always ended up getting sick if I went to gyms. And so I came across bodyweight training, calisthenics, and started doing that. And so I do that 3 times a week now. And it's great for me. And my absolute show-off is to say, at the grand old age of 44, I now have a six-pack.
Very impressive.
Which I didn't imagine would ever happen. so, that's good.
But is, obviously, feeling fit is great. But because you're on TV, does that put you under pressure?
Yeah, there's definitely elements of that. I mean, what's nice about the BBC and about Garden as well is they do, you know, they want us to be real. They want us to be us, which is great. So, yeah, I don't feel huge pressures, but, you know, I've been a bit run down this last year on a couple of occasions and had a sty on my eye and kind of thought, oh, can I go on TV looking like this? But then I ultimately think, you know, people are watching the show to look at plants and to learn. And, you know, my face is relatively irrelevant in that. So, yeah, so I feel it to an extent. And, but, you know, I'm interested in clothes and fashion and the like. So I enjoy that. I mean, I don't get such an opportunity doing the weekly show. But when it comes to doing the shows, you know, I get to wear... Get to wear slightly fancier things, which is nice. I made the error of wearing red trousers at Chelsea this year and then presented a piece from the Red Bridge, which meant
so
I was basically this torso just floating along. Absolutely, yeah.
Wonderful. So what would you garden in, though? What would be your comfortable gear for gardening in?
Well, that's a funny thing as well, because if I was to wear what I actually wear gardening for TV, I'd look like a rough sleeper. So for TV, I have to sort of slightly crank it up a bit. Yeah. And so, you know, I've got my real gardening jacket and then my tele-gardening jacket, which is a nice kind of wax jacket, which is useful. Yeah, so when I'm gardening at home, I tend to wear loose jeans or very, very heavy kind of canvas jeans and always a shirt, because I want to have the collar turned up. When I worked in South Africa, I was known by most of the team there as the Rooinek, redneck, of course. And I even seem to get sunburn on the back of my neck in winter. I don't know how I manage it. So, yeah, I think a shirt's great. Also means I can cover most of my body, because I'm sort of, in the last 5 years, just sort of become super aware of sun exposure. And if I look at the back of my hands, I think they look like a 50 or 60-year-old, because it just didn't dawn on me ever.
Oh, but you see, I really like gardeners to have old hands. But I've got this thing about it.
I think I've come to embrace it. Did you see Paul Dubois did that fantastic exhibition of gardeners' hands at the Garden Museum?
I didn't see it, but
it was lovely. Yeah, it had that kind of you know, certainly when I worked in nurseries in the past, and I'm sure you've experienced this, when peat starts to sort of stain your skin.
I'm proud of that. Look at that. That's
there you go.
Disgusting, isn't it, finger?
It's great. Well, look at my calluses. Look at these.
Oh, yeah.
So this is all from hard work. So, yeah, not too much dirt there at the moment.
I did have my hands in
compost yesterday.
There's a lot about people, the state of their hands. What's next for you? I mean, it sounds like when, you know, I look at what you've done an incredible amount, editing magazines, Chelsea Gardens, TV, worked in South Africa. Is there anything else left on the bucket list for gardening?
I feel so blessed, Tamsin, that I, in my 20s, probably had a series of ideas of things I'd like to do in my life. And I've done them all.
Retired.
Traveled around the world multiple times, written three books, worked on TV, botanic garden. I feel so blessed to have been able to do those things. And so I'm in this curious position now. I'm suddenly going, I've got to make up new stuff. So the big thing for me going forward would be to have an acre plus of my own that I can make into, you know, my special place. And I think I need to get on with it, you know. I'm going to be 50 in 6 years' time. You know, I need to start getting some trees in the ground.
Trees,
you know,
yeah.
I want to see a few things get to some level of maturity before I end up feeding them.
And what sort of style of garden would you go for, though?
I've got... some very distinct ideas that have been with me for so long. I need to have quite a roomed garden in a way. The gardens I'm always most drawn to are the sort of the arts and crafts. So, you know, Hidcote, Sissinghurst, Dixter, those sort of roomed gardens, but with a level of softness in between them. But there's really specific plantings that I want to do. For example, I have this one thing that I want to have a mini woodland of Rhus typhina, but underplanted with Astelia silver sword and then various martigan lilies. And so almost creating these slightly surreal landscapes, actually, sort of quite quite disparate plants, but creating very, very new aesthetics, but within an enclosed space.
I'm not surprised that you mentioned the plants you want to put in first. I can tell that's definitely your passion.
And I've also got this fantasy of, more at a design level actually, is to have a double set of herbaceous borders that's a circle, that's a donut. I've never Ooh. Seen it anywhere, and I think that would be great, that you can just walk around in this sort of endless circle. Now, purely from a design point of view, you could argue that there's no rest space there. It's motive space, so you'll keep moving. But I think it could be a really interesting dynamic. So if I imagine a sort of a hedged area that's maybe sort of 15 metres wide, you know, with 3-4 metre deep beds, and then being able to sort of walk through that, I think could be, yeah, really exciting.
But would you keep this garden private? Because it's interesting, you know, like Alan and Monty, their gardens aren't open, and I totally don't blame them for that, because you need some private space. Would you feel that that would be what you would want to do?
As you say, it's a fine line. I mean, your garden here is yours, isn't it? And I know with a physic garden, if I saw people messing with plants, I'd start to get really kind of protective about it.
It's very strange. We're sitting at the dining room here and at my garden, and when my uncle first opened it, we were sitting having lunch here, Sunday lunch, and people were peering through the windows.
Yeah, so invasive.
And it is invasive. And, you know, my grandmother couldn't put her knickers on the line anymore. You know, things like that were quite difficult. But actually now I've got really used to it and I love it.
Interesting.
Because it's fun, it's entertaining. And when everyone goes, when we close at the end of September, it's quite lonely.
Okay.
You know, I do find, gosh, I'm on my own now for 6 months.
I suppose, okay, so... Yeah, this is probably me being really precious, but the way I probably could cope with it most is if I opened up once a month and did a tour led by me, and then I can completely control it. And when there are people wandering through my peonies,
that is a difficult one. But going back to your childhood with your parents, so did they garden at all?
Yeah. So it was just so sort of normalised to me. So they had a medium-sized garden, and they bought another acre of land on the back, some of which was used as growing raspberries, and then gradually became more and more garden. And I somehow didn't realise, but by the time I was 12, I sort of was the head gardener. You know, I was running the whole garden. I was doing all the mowing, I was doing all the edging, I was doing all the planting. But it hadn't really dawned on me. And so that happened. But one of my earliest memories is being with my mother's parents, my grandparents, at a sort of sprawling farmhouse and 10 acres of orchards. And I remember just being in the gardens there, and they were beautiful. My grandparents on the other side also had a large garden, and then they still owned my grandfather's father's cottage as well, which had this beautiful sloping garden. And bearing in mind we're in West Norfolk, a sloping garden was a rare thing indeed.
Yeah.
And so I was fascinated by this garden. And so my childhood was just, you know, we were very, very outdoor kids anyway. That was just the way TV was just, a novel thing. Sometimes you did on a Saturday morning, but otherwise we were just out in the garden. So gardens and gardening, you know, across the family, there were, you know, big gardens, and it was just normal. And so both sets of, you know, grandmothers and my mother, all women, interestingly. There's no sort of male gardeners particularly, but sort of had that influence. It's interesting.
Yeah, it definitely helps, I think, if you've grown up out, being kicked out the door, get out, it's nice, go and make the most of the weather.
I mean, it must be extraordinary for you, this having been a childhood's home, and it was owned and controlled in certain ways, and now it's yours. How have you sort of evolved it in that?
I think, well, my sister and I, we run the garden with my uncle, and it's a very slow process, really. But I think what people pick up when they visit any open garden that's still a home is there is that element of love that you feel from a place. And we're just totally in love with this place because it's been in my family for generations. So I think that comes through to people.
Yeah.
And what I find fascinating is people really want to know the past, the history. They want to know that, you know, my grandmother used to have sheets all on the patio area out there covered in walnuts drying in the sun, and they love seeing my mum pick the raspberries. And that sort of side of it is what I love, is the family, the history, and all the fun things that we've done here. So who are your heroes, talking of people?
My horticultural heroes. So my ultimate would be Roberta Burley-Marx, who I think is just was an exceptional human being. I don't know how well known he is to people generally, but of course he was a South American Brazilian designer. Probably the thing most people would know or recognise as his is the entire beachfront of Rio de Janeiro is him.
Right.
So that beautiful black and white multi-pattern paving, it's obviously heavily planted as well, but the paving is so iconic in these tiny little sets, almost like mosaic. But he was based in Sao Paulo and then created gardens across the country. What blows my mind about him is that he rose to the top of his field in landscape architecture. I mean, he designed Brasilia, you know, all the external landscape of Brasilia. He rose to the top of his field as a theatre designer, as a canvas artist, as a sculptor, as a botanist, and as a plant hunter, all in one lifetime. And I think that's incredible.
So there's a model for you to work on. Sculpture, plant hunting. I can see you plant hunting.
That's a bit of a push, but you know what a polymath, an extraordinary thing to have achieved. And he also, while Europe was quite sort of inward looking and had sort of, you know, moved on from gardens of the Renaissance or gardens of the 18th century, the European aesthetic wasn't really that influenced by anything else. And somehow in South America, he created this totally new aesthetic that had nothing to do with Europe and European design. And if you look at, you know, say India or Africa, where gardens have been exported, they are all heavily European influenced, even in Australia. Whereas he set up something completely different. And, you know, I was talking earlier about this sort of bird's eye view designing, and he can be accused of that because he created these vast sort of patterns on the landscape, monoculture blocks of plants. It was sort of nearly cuboid, but with rounded corners. But he understood the spaces he was creating by doing that. So I think he generated really dynamic landscapes. The sadness for me is I've traveled all over the world. I've been in some really dangerous places. And I think I've just lost my nerve because I now want to go to Brazil and see his landscapes for real. And I'm just a little bit scared.
You can do it. If you've built a Chelsea garden, you can certainly travel to Brazil. It would be a walk in the park. Well, shall we go and get some fresh air? Go and look around the garden, because you've got a train to catch. We can't let them, you know, miss you in Maidenhead tonight.
Yes, indeed, indeed. The glamorous life of a travelling gardener.
I enjoyed my first encounter with Nick Bailey. He proved to me that his passion for horticulture is incredible and his plant knowledge is second to none. In my next podcast, I'm off to meet Anne-Marie Powell. She's a fantastic garden designer. Fresh from the Pod is presented by me, Tamsin Westhorpe, and produced by Candide in their plant-filled Bristol office. Candide is a free plant and gardening app with a helpful community of plant lovers, interesting articles and great tools like plant identification and garden tours. Ask a question in the app with the hashtag #FreshFromThePod and I'll choose my favourite to answer later in the series. And if you enjoyed Fresh From The Pod, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, share it on Reddit and talk about it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe.